Hi again, I'm Kathleen Dunn. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Thursday, the 27th of March. Our guest this hour is the author of a very interesting piece that appears in the On Earth issue, the current issue of On Earth, spring of 2008. Requiem for a River is the name of the article. Once upon a time, there was enough water in the Colorado for everyone to have a share of its bounty. Not anymore. A journey down the once mighty river reveals the future of the American West in a changing climate. Tim is our guest this hour, series editor for the annual Best American Science and Nature Writing Anthology, contributing editor to Discover, and he took this long journey down the Colorado and met with all kinds of people and visited various communities and went to different states and looks at the crisis facing the Southwest. For those of you who have been there, you know that there is a lack of water. The question is whether or not is urban development a goal to be pursued at any cost, or as one rancher asked Tim, do we want lawns or lettuce, craps or crops? Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Joining us in Milwaukee, it is 414-227-2050, 414-227-2050. And if you'd like to send an email, okay, talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. Hi, Tim.
Hi, Kathleen.
Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks very much for having me.
Let's just start, before we talk about your journey, the number of people who are moving to this part of the country, which really does astound me. There are a huge number of people who think this is paradise. I'm not sure why, but they do.
Well, you know, there are so many nice places to live here. I live in a small town in the northwestern corner of New Mexico, and the scenery is, you know, just spectacular. Though we're quite high, the winters can be quite cold, but you know, even at our elevation of 6,500 feet, most days in the winter, you can count on nice sunny days. You know, and if you go to lower elevations in this state or in Arizona, of course, the winters are really nice here.
Mm-hmm.
But you're right about, you know, the population growth. The Southwest has been the fastest growing part of the country for, you know, more than a decade. Arizona, between 1990 and 2000, the population went from 3.7 million to, I think it was 5.1 million,
Woo!
Which is about a 40% increase. Colorado's population increased 30% in that same time.
Oh, my gosh.
And in the Clark County in Nevada, which includes Las Vegas, the Clark County's water use doubled between 1985 and 2000. So, yeah, there is, and it's in the Southwest. Is still the fastest growing population. I think right now the fastest growing town in the country is a place called St. George in Utah.
Wow. Well, 10 years from now, you'll all be moving to Wisconsin.
I know. You better get ready for an influx of visitors.
We'll plan for your arrival when the water runs dry, right?
That's right.
Yeah, you met so many fascinating people. You start the story, I can't remember where you were, but with the story of this rancher who owned quite a few acres, and you asked him a question which you didn't know you were supposed to ask, how many acres he had and how much money he had been offered his land because of water rights.
That's right. That was Dean Baker. He's a rancher in Snake Valley, Nevada, which is about 300 miles northeast of Las Vegas. Dean, and he raises some cattle, a few other crops, alfalfa, corn, I think. He lives very simply he has a very modest home behind a gas station in the town of Baker, population about 50. Baker's in the middle of one of the emptiest regions in the United States, called the Great Basin. There's a national park nearby called Great Basin National Park, which is a beautiful place, but I think it's the least visited national park in the country just because it's so remote.
Hmm.
The highway that goes through Baker, Highway 50, Life magazine once called the loneliest road in America.
Hmm.
And it is quite lonely, but also quite beautiful. And so Dean Baker has a ranch up there, and he's been offered, I think it was $20 million by a real estate developer who was more interested in what was underneath Baker's Ranch, then the ranch itself, and what's underneath, you know, Baker's Ranch is water, and you know, Las Vegas is looking at the water underneath that ranch and other ranches in the valleys of northern Nevada, because Las Vegas is facing some serious water shortages.
Mm-hmm. And so they're interested in telling me where what the status is, because you write about this, in constructing this very expensive pipeline to get that water, right?
That's right, a huge pipeline. The price tag, I think, for the pipeline is about $2 billion, you know, but it could be more. And this is a pipeline that would be about 7 feet in diameter, big enough, as one rancher put it to me, to drive a good-sized pickup truck through. Las Vegas desperately needs another source of water, because right now the city gets 90% of its water from Lake Mead, and Lake Mead is basically a reservoir that's fed by the Colorado River. So Las Vegas is getting 90% of its water from the Colorado River, and that's not going to be enough. They project by, I think it's about 2015, that Las Vegas, you know, just won't have enough water from Lake Mead to supply all the, you know, expected population growth. So they have plans to extract water from a number of valleys in the northern part of the state, and the people who live in those areas, there aren't a lot of people who live up there, but the people who do live there are really concerned that, you know, it will damage their ranches and farms, and also more, probably even more importantly, you know, just damage the ecosystem of the Great Basin.
Hmm. Are they right?
It seems to me, you know, I think the weight of evidence is on their side. I spoke with a scientist named Jim Deacon, an ecologist who's been studying the Great Basin for, he's retired now, but he studied the deserts probably in that region more than anyone probably, and he's basically on the farmer's side. He thinks that pumping would be a disaster across the Great Basin, that the aquifers in the Great Basin, which, you know, support you know, some kind of tough but also fragile vegetation in the area. He thinks the aquifers would be, it could be seriously damaged by the sorts of pumping that Las Vegas is planning.
Mm-hmm. You have interviews with people along the Colorado River and different places you went to. You were in Las Vegas and have an interesting interview with Pat Mulroy, the general manager of the Southern Nevada Water Authority, who's maybe running for governor at some point, who, you know, can't really say we got a problem here. Maybe as many people shouldn't be moving here as are because of the water problem, because you can't do that if you're going to run for governor. You want to grow, right? You can't put a moratorium on your growth, but maybe you should.
Right. Yeah, I think she's constrained. You know, she's a very smart, capable woman, and very dynamic, you know, I think well aware of all the issues that are involved. But her number one responsibility, you know, as the manager of the Southern Nevada Water Authority, is to make sure that water keeps coming out of the taps and the hotels and the homes in Las Vegas. You know, if that doesn't happen, she'd be out of a job. So she's under tremendous pressure just to secure water for Las Vegas.
Mm-hmm. And so the question which you ask at the end here is a fairly profound question. Should we be pursuing in that part of the country and other parts of the country, too, urban development? Or as a rancher asked you, do we want lawns or lettuce, craps or crops? That's a fairly profound question.
It is. It's a big issue. And I haven't seen it discussed so much whenever you know, stories are written about the drought, that there is this, you know, there are these two opposing needs, you know, that haven't been opposed for most of the 20th century, because somehow we managed to sustain both, you know, this amazing population growth in the Southwest and still also keep up, you know, a lot of productive agriculture but it doesn't look like we'll be able to continue that in this century. So this the need for our food supply might conflict with the kind of unbridled urban growth that the Southwest has just been experiencing for the past 30 or 40 years.
Are people watering their lawns in some of these urban areas?
Yes, it's one thing. I think the thing that struck me over and over again as I was traveling through the region. Perhaps the most egregious example was an incident that I didn't mention in the story. I traveled all around the Salton Sea, which is this huge inland lake in southern California, just north of the Imperial Valley. It's the lake is an artificial lake. It's fed entirely by agricultural runoff. But still, it's an important, over the past, since the lake was formed early in the 20th century, it's become an important, stop for migrating birds. But as I was driving around this lake in late spring last year, it was around noon, incredibly hot day, dusty, and I just out of curiosity, I started driving through some of the housing developments that are built on the shores of the lake, and there were lots of little houses with their plots with the green lawns and sprinklers going full tilt at noon, on a 100 degree day. It's just you just can't believe it.
I'm sure you couldn't believe it, particularly after doing this story. All right, let's go back quite a few years, more than 80 years ago, I think, when these western states hammered out the pact dividing up the water in the Colorado River. It was quite a different world. What was the pact?
That's the Colorado River Compact, and that's the overarching framework that, to this day, governs how the water in the Colorado River is shared among the seven states that use the river's water. The seven states are Wyoming, Colorado, Utah, and New Mexico, Arizona, Nevada, and California. And the compact divides those seven states into two so-called basins, an upper basin and a lower basin. The upper basin is Wyoming, Colorado, Utah, and New Mexico, and the lower basin is Arizona, Nevada, and California. And the compact assigns half the river's average annual flow to the upper basin and half the river's average annual flow to the lower basin. The problem that has come to light, in the past several years is that scientists now know that the 20th century and ironically, especially the early 20th century when the compact was signed, was an unusually wet period compared with a long-term flow of the river that has been reconstructed by studying tree rings, going back several hundred years now. The average annual flow of the river is probably at least 10% less than the signers of the compact assumed. So essentially, we've been using more water than the river actually than is in the river actually in any given year.
Mm-hmm. Let's start with your journey at the beginning of the Colorado River, where you had it was cold and you went on a journey to measure snowfall, to measure amount of water that's going from the snow seeping into help form and fill the Colorado River. Tell me about that journey.
Okay. Yes, I, again, last spring, early in the spring, I traveled with a scientist named Jill Barron, who has been studying snowpack in the Rocky Mountains for about 20 years now. She's made hundreds of trips, and it's quite a grueling hike. The day I went up with her, there was snow was falling. It was quite cold, and we were snowshoeing on top of about 5 feet of snow. And I was surprised to learn that it's about 70 to 80% of the water in the Colorado River comes from melting snow, and about half the water in the river that reaches Hoover Dam down near Las Vegas comes from just 15% of the river's watershed up in the Rocky Mountains. So that snowpack is crucial to the health of the river. And Jill Barron and other scientists, this is not just unique to the Rocky Mountains, but snowpack across the western United States has been decreasing over the past decade at least, since Jill Barron has been studying her area in the Rocky Mountains. She told me that the peak snowmelt is now occurring 3 to 4 weeks earlier than it was several years ago. So in a sense that it's the, the almost like spring is or spring or summer is kind of being pushed back 3 to 4 weeks earlier in that alpine environment.
And there's a whole series, I wasn't aware of this, the National Atmospheric Deposition Program, which collects such data all over the country on snowfall?
That's right. I have a number of papers on my computer about similar studies in the Cascade Mountains in the Northwest, and they all show similar results that not only is the snowmelt occurring earlier each season, but there is less snow falling on the mountains. So you have this kind of double whammy where there's less snow and on the mountains in the first place, and what snow there is melting earlier each year.
But what about rainfall? You talk about rainfall and there being, I believe, maybe more rainfall, or at least as much as there has been. Wouldn't that make up the deficit?
Yeah, that's a good question. If, as global warming settles into the Southwest, more precipitation will fall as rain and less as snow. It's expected that overall precipitation will decrease in the Southwest. But even if the overall precipitation stayed the same, the mechanics of that snow melt are such that the volume of water released in a relatively short period of time is more effective at penetrating the ground and the soil than intermittent rains are. You could kind of imagine just the intermittent rain just soaking the upper parts of the soil, but that larger volume of water that comes down from the mountains in the spring and early summer is much more effective at pushing its way deeper into the soil, and that's what really recharges the region's aquifers.
You talk about, let's go back to the pact for a moment. Until 2007, so for 80-plus years, there was no incentive for any of the states to limit their withdrawal from the Colorado River. The system encouraged the states to use their full allocation or risk losing the water to another state.
Yeah, it was kind of, it seems perverse now, especially, that we're in the middle of a drought and we're kind of smacking our heads saying, well, how could we let that situation happen? But, in the most of the 20th century, it wasn't a problem. The water made possible the growth of, cities like Phoenix and Tucson. Las Vegas, of course, they would all be small towns without water from the Colorado River. And so now it looks kind of silly that was allowed, but the mindset was, well, there's a lot of water in the river and it's flowing year in, year out. So we kind of, the assumption was that, the climate is going to be stable. We know what the past flows have been. The U.S. Geological Survey, the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation has been keeping records of the river flow in the Colorado for about 100 years, and they know what the average annual flow is for the 100 years. So they felt pretty safe in the amount of water that they were allowing to be used. But you're right, there was no incentive for conservation. But now, just this past winter, the three lower basin states, Nevada, California, and Arizona, agreed on strategies to share and conserve water in the event of shortages, and how those shortages will be what the burden of those shortages will be.
Tim Folger is our guest this hour. He is the author of a very interesting piece in the current issue of On Earth magazine, Requiem for a River. More than 80 years ago, seven Western states hammered out a pact dividing up the water in the Colorado River. Agriculture was king, Las Vegas just a railroad watering stop in the middle of nowhere. Today, after an eight-year drought, the river is in crisis. He traveled from its snow-fed headwaters, rather, to the feeble trickle that enters the Gulf of California, asking everyone he met what comes next. 800-486-8655 is our number. If you're in Milwaukee, please use 227-2050 or send an email, talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to phone calls for Tim Folger and start with Eric from Appleton. Hi, Eric. Hello, Eric.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead.
Oh, yeah. I actually have a couple of different questions. I was wondering, is Lake Mead being depleted because of all the use? And also, I've been hearing the news quite a bit that Arizona's changed some laws as far as how employees have to be proving their ID. And a lot of illegal immigrants are going back home. And I was wondering if those high enough numbers to affect the amount of water usage. And then also, one of the easiest way to control population is just make water more expensive and let let the market just float up as becomes a limited resource. And that's it.
All right, thanks for the call.
Yeah, good questions, Erica. Yes, both the two big reservoirs on the Colorado are Lake Mead and Lake Powell, and they're both being depleted. They're both less than half full. It's shortly after I finished my, when I was working on the story, I kept wondering, gee, am I overstating this problem? Am I making this crisis seem more serious than it really is? And then after I had finished writing my story and after it had already been edited and it was getting set to be printed, a study came out from a scientist at Scripps Institution of Oceanography at the University of California, San Diego. This study projected that Lake Mead could be completely dry in just 13 years.
Oh, my.
So it's kind of hard to overstate the seriousness of the problem. As far as immigrants, I don't think that's... I don't think they're making an impact on so much on the water crisis. I think the real culprit is throughout the entire region. Agriculture uses most of the water. There has to be more efficient water conserving agricultural practices, and also outdoor watering use is the largest source of, I think outdoor water use accounts for something like 70% of residential water use. Just lawns and shrubbery. Las Vegas is trying to, and other cities in the Southwest are trying to implement measures that will encourage or actually forbid certain types of landscaping. I think since 2003 now, Las Vegas has required that all new homes not have lawns in their front yards. They have to have dry landscaping or xeriscaping, as it's called, and that the backyards can have no more than half the backyard covered with lawn. Pricing, yes, probably water prices will go up, and that has been shown to be an incentive to reduce water use. So, yeah, that's probably in the cards for the entire region.
You would think that, obviously, green grass, that just doesn't grow very naturally. People have to go to extremes to keep lawns, I would think, in some of these areas. You would have thought that many years ago people would have thought, hey, this doesn't seem to be working out very well. I need to put something else in my front yard.
You would think, but, where I live here in Gallup, New Mexico, a lot of people have, kind of desert landscaped yards. We have just like red rock gravel in our front yard. You'll see a lot of homes with lawns, and there are restrictions on watering, alternate day watering, and you can only water in the morning or the evening, and that's enough to keep a little patch of green lawn going. But some people just really like those lawns for,
I guess
their kids to run around in. It's an attachment, but it's one we'll probably have to let. We'll certainly have to let go of here in the Southwest.
Ned from Wausau. Hi, Ned.
Hi. One comment I have follows up on what you were just talking about. I lived in a Phoenix, Arizona suburb for 7 years in the 1980s, and they used what was called irrigation, which was flooding their lawns that would have a little berm around the outside to a depth of about 6 to 8 inches, and they do it every 2 weeks. And they had caliche clay for soil, then a little topsoil on top. But it would be very slow percolation, and during the process, a great deal of the water would evaporate before it ever percolated into the soil. So that really is counterproductive, and I think I did convert my front lawn to desert landscaping and gravel, as the guest suggested. I think that's a great idea. And, in fact, I think it should be made the law in every city of those dry states, New Mexico, Arizona, Nevada, especially Southern California would be a good idea. I had one other comment, if I could. That is the Great Lakes Compact, and the reason this fits in is because a lot of the states in the West would like to have Great Lakes water. And, several states around the Great Lakes have already passed the compact, which would not allow water outside the Great Lakes watershed or the Great Lakes Basin. And Wisconsin has passed it in the state Senate, but not in the state assembly. And I think it's a time for us to contact those of us that have members in the assembly, which have a Republican majority, and they did not pass it before they adjourned. This really needs to be addressed in the next session, and we need to get it passed by both houses because the governor said he would sign it. And we need to get on board along with several states that have already passed it so that we keep the Great Lakes water where it is. And the reason that's important is because navigation requires certain levels. It's much more expensive for navigation if the water levels get too low. That's just one of many reasons, along with the drinking water supply of tens of millions of people, and we don't own the water. It's both U.S. and Canada joint-owned. So if we ship it out to, let's say, Colorado, Nebraska, Arizona, New Mexico, or Texas, it really is not only expensive, but it's really not a good idea.
Tim.
Yeah, it's, one of the... there's so many astonishing things in this story. Last spring, I attended a meeting in Utah where people were talking about the Colorado River Compact and whether it would have to be adjusted to, in these decades ahead, as we're faced with global warming and, all these issues, population growth, and where is the Southwest going to get its water from? And I couldn't believe that people were seriously, and these are water managers. Pat Mulroy was at this meeting. She's the head of the Southern Nevada Water Authority. People were seriously talking about building a water pipeline from the Mississippi River and pumping water up to the Southwest. Even though people are talking about that, I can't see that ever happening. A similar project was floated back in the 70s, I think, to bring water. I forget if it was from the Mississippi or Texas, but it was a long pipeline that was supposed to bring water to the Southwest. And the problem is the Southwest, much of the Southwest is pretty high. The Colorado Plateau where I live, and that covers most of northern Arizona, southern Colorado, northern New Mexico, and southern Utah is, well over a mile high. And, to pump water, from the Mississippi to more than a mile in elevation, that's going to require a lot of fossil fuel. Mm-hmm. And, when you burn fossil fuel, you're adding to the global warming problem, which is going to make the Southwest drier. So, I can't really see these big pipeline projects ever, and just the expense of building these things. And I just can't see them being built.
Thanks very much for your call, Ned. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Jim, who is in Wisconsin, but it's from Norwood, Colorado, is our next caller. Hi, Jim.
Hi.
Hi.
First of all, I got one quick. I irrigate 5 to 10 acres of land, and I'm obviously listening to your program with great interest, and I love your show. I have one comment. First of all, we caught a break this year the snowpack in Colorado is above average, so we got at least maybe 1 year of relief. But my question is, why is the early snow melt a problem, considering we have these huge reservoirs of Meade and Powell? And I'll take the answer off the air.
All right, Jim, thank you.
Yeah, the it's not, there are unanswered questions about what happens with an earlier snowmelt. When I was speaking with Joe Barron, the scientist who was studying snowpack in the Colorado Rockies, she said, "Well, what happens when the vegetation in these alpine ecosystems gets this charge of water, basically a month earlier than has been the case? Does the region dry? Does the vegetation dry out earlier?" Does that mean that there will be an increased risk of fire later in the season because the vegetation has been drying that much longer? Those are the sorts of questions that scientists are looking at now. But I think that one likely possibility is that the risk of fire will increase just because the dry period will have been extended.
We go next to Matt from Lake Geneva. Hi, Matt.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I've lived in a number of the areas that you've referred to, particularly I've lived along the Colorado River in Colorado before, and I've lived in California where water issues are a big deal. And surprisingly, I learned that southern cities in California are also drawing water off the Colorado River. San Diego in particular gets a lot of water from the very lower part of the Colorado River. But one of the interesting things I learned while I was living in California is that while there's a lot of emphasis on individual household use of water, it's really agriculture that's using the bulk of water in California. The numbers I saw at the time were in the early 90s were 30% of the water was going to fuel cities like San Diego, Los Angeles, and San Francisco, but 70% was going to agriculture. Now, then after that, you have to look at what kind of agriculture are they doing with this water. In California, they grow a large rice crop, and they grow a lot of cotton. And both of these are very water-intensive crops, and they're growing them in valleys like the Sacramento Valley, which is really a desert. So you can imagine, you can picture this in your head. They're flooding fields in the desert to grow crops of rice. And then it turns out that these farmers are not able to grow rice in this area without tremendous subsidies from the taxpayer. So you have the bulk of this water going to be used for what is really a kind of a crazy scheme.
All right, let's get a response. Tim?
Yeah, I think, I can't really address the issues of the rice growing up in the Sacramento Valley. I don't really know anything about that, but it's certainly true that agriculture uses the bulk of California's water, and the Imperial Valley, which I visited while working on my story, is even more of a desert than what the Sacramento Valley would be. The Imperial Valley is essentially this green oasis in the middle of the Sonoran Desert, and the only reason it exists is because there's a canal, the All-American Canal, that brings water from the Colorado River to the farms in the Imperial Valley that makes farming possible there. The entire region would just be a desert without the canal and water brings from the river. So, yes, you're right. The agriculture still uses the bulk of water across the Southwest. I think it's about at least 70%. The senior water right holders in most states are farmers. That's true in California. The farmers in the Imperial Valley have the most senior rights to the Colorado River's water of anyone in the seven states. So agricultural practices will certainly have to change, but the rate of the balance of water use is starting to shift, even though agriculture still uses the bulk of it. That's going to change in the decades ahead. Just one sign of that change, I think, was an agreement that was worked out between San Diego and the farmers in the Imperial Valley to to send some of the water from the Imperial Valley to the city of San Diego, and it's an agreement that the farmers in the Imperial Valley are not very happy with. They feel it was, as one farmer put it to me, that the agreement was shoved down their throat.
Thanks very much for your call, Matt. Our number is 800-486-8655. Tim Folger, our guest, and he has a very interesting piece, Requiem for a River, which appears in the spring edition of On Earth magazine. He traveled a long way from the beginning of the Colorado River to the feeble trickle, as the article says, that enters the Gulf of California, asking everyone he met what comes next. We also have an email. If you can't call in and you want to send us an email, you can do that. That is talk@WPR.org, talk@WPR.org. One line is open. 800-486-8655 is the number. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Tim Folger, our guest, our number 800-486-8655. Joan from Milwaukee, hi.
Hello. As part of a small group that sued Perrier Nestle's from take and kept them from taking Ice Mountain water out from the Dells area, the issue that seems to be forgotten from the World Water Forum that was in The Hague back in March 2000 was they wanted to say water was a commodity. So a handful of transnational corporations backed by the World Bank and the International Monetary Fund, they started taking over the management of public water services, and it raised the price of water, and it certainly ruined the price in the third world. And their agenda was, we're going to make water a commodity, and boy, we're going to make money, because if you own the water, you own the people. And at the same time, governments were signing away the water with NAFTA, and the FTAA and the World Trade Organization says they won't loan money to a country unless they privatize water. And when Bechtel went down and bought up all the water rights in Bolivia, it was chaos, and they're suing the government. Corporations have started suing over the water, and this activity is taking place without the public knowing anything.
Tim.
Yes, I've read a little bit about those privatization efforts in South America. It's not something I know very much about, but yes, I agree with the caller that I think that it's a disaster, water shouldn't be a for-profit commodity. It should be managed for the public good as much as possible. But I think I agree with the caller from what I've read. Those efforts have been a disaster, especially for the poor in South America.
Thanks, Joan, for the call. We have an email from Jim. I traveled the Colorado River route twice 20 years ago for the National Geographic feature they did, A River Drained Dry. And the Denver Post, and I was struck that even that the closer you were to the river's end, the greater the water saving conservation and more careful the measuring. I always had the impression that thousands of acres of alfalfa and corn flooded every spring in Colorado was a grossly outdated methodology, and that if the upper river parsed its water as closely as California does, there would be several more decades of life for everyone. Has anything changed in this regard?
I don't think too much has changed with the upper basin, agricultural practices. I think that's pretty much still holds true. Although in some ways the upper basin is at a disadvantage because they have an obligation. There's four upper basin states. They under the Colorado River Compact, they're required to make sure that the three lower basin states get that their due of half the Colorado River's average annual flow. That compact prevents any shortages to the lower basin states as a result of whatever practices might be happening in the upper basin. But yeah, I agree with the caller that agriculture conservation practices could use a lot of improvement.
Mm-hmm. Dick from Waukesha, hi.
Yes, I was away from the phone briefly, or was talking to the person who answered the phone, and I didn't hear. Maybe you mentioned the aquifers underneath those areas, but if you didn't, you might. Also, I think that the lawns and golf courses and all that, most of the people who live in that Phoenix area are antiques like me, and they're going to die soon, the same as I am, so they probably don't give a rap. I have a son who isn't one of those, and I hope he doesn't water his lawn. I think they ought to have gravel and spray it green, but I do want to hear you talk about the aquifer, and also how about Mexico? They're out of the picture totally, are they? The Colorado River?
And no,
go deliver meals on wheels. I'll listen to you on the
thanks,
radio.
Thanks, Dick. Thanks. Okay, thanks for the call.
Aquifers are, this source of, it's kind of like a savings bank of water that, especially, the ones that I looked into mostly were the aquifers in the Great Basin that Las Vegas would like to have access to. But the problem is, that's water that's been stored for, centuries in many cases, and once that water's gone, it takes a long time for the aquifers to recharge. As for Mexico, yes, I regret that the original draft of my story had an entire section about Mexico, but there just wasn't enough room to include it in the final version of the story. So I'm hoping that I can address that in another article or book. But yeah, it was in many ways the most interesting part of the story, I thought, because if you look at maps of the Colorado River, you see this blue line kind of squiggling its way all the way from the Rocky Mountains to the Gulf of California. But in reality, if you go looking for the Colorado River in Mexico, you're not going to find it. There is no Colorado River, essentially, in Mexico anymore. It disappears pretty much as soon as you step across the border. There's a town right across from the Imperial Valley, which I visited, called Mexicali, just on the Mexican side of the border. And a dam there diverts the last of the Colorado River's water for use in agriculture in the state of Baja California in Mexico. When you kind of try to follow the river south of you're just looking at a dry riverbed. There's really no river, no Colorado River anymore in Mexico. Here and there, there are places where agricultural runoff fills parts of the old riverbed. And there are, I spoke with environmental groups in Mexico who are trying to restore stretches of the river and who would like to have a guaranteed release of water that would maintain the river throughout Mexico. It wouldn't take much of a dedicated release, if Mexico and the United States could cooperate on that issue, it wouldn't be a lot. Aldo Leopold wrote a wonderful book back in the 1940s about his travels in the Colorado River Delta, and he described it as this incredibly lush place of green lagoons with lots of wildlife, and jaguars even, and that's pretty much all disappeared. There's a remnant swamp called La Cienega de Santa Clara that's sustained now entirely by agricultural runoff, but that's threatened now, ironically, by conservation measures in the United States. This All-American Canal that brings water from the Imperial Valley, from the Colorado River to the Imperial Valley, is being lined with concrete, and that's going to kind of end the seepage that is feeding farms in northern Mexico. So there's just so many stories along the river that it's hard to include them all in one one article.
Right. Is this being talked about in the presidential race at all? Does it need to be?
I think it should, especially in light of that research that I mentioned earlier from the Scripps Institution of Oceanography that Lake Mead could be dry in 13 years, and if that happens, I mean, Lake Mead is a water supply for I don't know, 20 million people maybe.
or Lake Mead and Lake Powell together, I think, supply the water for about 25 million people. Lake Mead is the major, you know, water source for Arizona, Nevada, and Southern California. And if that's dry, that would be a calamity. So it should be an issue.
Mm-hmm. Let's go next to Frank from Sheboygan. Hi, Frank.
Good morning.
Hi.
My comment is kind of related to something I heard about development here in Sheboygan. Natural gas was brought to Sheboygan, and there was a certain size pipeline, and it had a certain capacity. And when it was determined that building more houses with gas furnaces could not be sustained by this pipeline, there was a restriction placed on contractors to build homes with electric heating. Now, the situation has changed. There's a larger capacity pipeline that can build homes with gas heating. And the thing that I wonder, is it too much to hope that people will ever realize that there are some limits that you can't transcend? I'm thinking about the nature documentaries I see on television where some species will not reproduce unless the conditions are right. There's enough food, enough resources for them to raise their young to maturity. And it seems to me that I don't like to say that there have to be limits that you can't hope to transcend, but maybe there are some limits truly that are more than even our technology and our will can transcend. We have to just say there isn't enough water. We mm-hmm. can't grow anymore.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, yes, I think that's true. John Wesley Powell, the great explorer of the 19th century, who was the first European to travel through the Grand Canyon by the river, he said that water was always going to limit growth in the Southwest, and I think he's right. I think the Southwest is going to face limits, whether they're imposed by local governments or whether they're kind of forced upon us. One scientist I spoke with, Julio Betancourt, he's with the U.S. Geological Survey, working at the Desert Laboratory in Tucson, Arizona. The Desert Laboratory is part of the University of Arizona. And he said that he feels that the Southwest in the decades ahead may just become a less desirable place to live with the water restrictions, and he thinks there will be a greatly increased risk of fire. Already, he was pointing out on maps to me new housing developments being built in these high fire risk areas. He just said with the cost of insurance or maybe not being able to get insurance for homes in such areas, he said that the Southwest just may not be as desirable location in the decades ahead, so the growth might be curtailed naturally.
Thanks very much for the call. We have time for one more call, probably. Andrew from La Crosse. Hi.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Just a quick observation. I lived in Southern California, Phoenix, Scottsdale, Arizona for about 2-3 year period just before 2005. And, one of the things about Southwest is, they have a whole new set of problems we don't have in the Midwest. But one of them was, that I noticed on a daily basis was the water issue and the watering of the golf courses. I mean, I drive by golf courses on a daily basis on the way to work, just appalled. I mean, that there's these lush green golf courses, and I'm not going to lie, they're beautiful, but and I'm not up for conservationist of the year, but I think there are better ways to manage that water. And I have heard you talk about the wasting of the water on various crops and whatnot, the rice and whatnot, but that's the ultimate waste to me. And these lawns, I think one of the sacrifices you make in living in the Southwest is that you get 350 days of sun a year, but you are also going to sacrifice the green grass.
Tim.
Yeah, that's true. I think for now, cities like San Diego have these, they put a lot of effort into encouraging, the water users to, replace, water-heavy outdoor vegetation with xeriscaping. But for now, all those are all kind of voluntary practices. They'll probably have to become mandatory. Golf courses, too. I visited one golf course in Las Vegas where the manager was ripping up
you know, lots of the greens, you know, replacing you know, turf with bare sand, just kind of keeping the green to a minimum. So I don't know whether golf courses will be able to survive or not. But at least one golf course in Las Vegas was they were using recycled water, you know, to irrigate the course, and so maybe there's still a place for golf in a drier Southwest, but I'm not sure.
Tim, thank you so much. Thanks for the article; it was fascinating.
Oh, thank you very much, Kathleen, for your interest.
Tim Folger, our guest. You can find Requiem for a River in the spring edition of On Earth, or you can go to onearth.org. He is went from the beginning of the river to where it entered the Gulf of California, and asking everybody what comes next. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing the hour, to John Treader for on-air production here in our Milwaukee studios, and thanks everybody for all of your calls and for listening. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.